the headlines. Iran's top negotiator says some JCPOA parties are stuck in a blame game amid ongoing talks in Vienna on the removal of sanctions. The U.S. says it's aiming for stronger defense alliances in the Indo-Pacific after accusing China of acting aggressively in the region. And the Yemeni army declares major gains in the fight against Saudi-backed forces in the Flashpoint province of Ma'arib. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Iran's lead negotiator accuses some parties in Vienna talks of still playing the blame game, even as fresh round of diplomacy is in progress for the removal of sanctions. Ali Bagherikani says diplomacy is a two-way street, and that Iran has worked constructively and flexibly to narrow the gaps during the talks. He believes that securing a good deal is possible if the parties resolve to do so. Comments come in reaction to Western diplomats questioning the progress of the seventh round of the talks. Iran says that it is seeking to work out a good deal that will ensure the rights and interests of its people. Tehran says the termination of U.S. sanctions is the main result that it wants to see from these negotiations, and only then will it resume its nuclear commitments. We've spoken to writer and political commentator Brian Berletich. He believes the U.S. was reluctant to make a meaningful deal from the very beginning.
I think from the very beginning, the U.S. had no real intention of making any sort of meaningful deal with Iran. I think from the very beginning, they wanted to make this deal to make it look like the U.S. wanted to pursue peace. They deliberately sabotaged it. We watched them do it in front of the entire world. And now they want to double down on belligerence toward Iran in pursuit of isolating Iran. And I think that has already played out. It hasn't really worked that well for the United States. And it just seems very unlikely that they would somehow find good faith to actually pursue this deal, which I don't think they were genuinely interested in from the very beginning, all the way back when it was first signed.
Iran says it's turning down a request by the International Atomic Energy Agency to access the Karaj site because that is beyond what has been agreed to in the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the Safeguards Agreement. Nuclear Chief Mohammad Islami says Iran's cooperation with the IAEA will only be limited to the NPT and the Safeguards Agreement, and nothing beyond that is acceptable. According to Islami, the Karaj case has been resolved and closed under the 2015 nuclear deal. He added that the Karaj issue and other alleged cases being raised by the agency are interrelated and need to be addressed together. Islami noted that if the IAEA is seeking access to Karaj under the nuclear deal, then all the other parties should move to fulfill their obligations. Only in that case, Iran will do the same. The official says demands other than that are only meant for political pressure, and that Iran takes no heed of allegations fueled by Israeli propaganda. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Now, earlier we told you about Washington accusing Beijing of behaving in an aggressive manner in the Asia-Pacific. Now here comes the anticipated reaction from Beijing.
The U.S.'s attempts to provoke splits and misunderstandings and incite antagonism and confrontation are not welcome anywhere in the world and will certainly not work in the Asia-Pacific region.
Spokesman said the U.S. is playing up the China threat, but is in fact pursuing a divisive policy in the region. Wang said that Washington's stance contradicts its own frequent military deployments in the South China Sea. Earlier, the U.S. Secretary of State accused China of behaving in an aggressive manner in the Indo-Pacific. Anthony Blinken, who is currently visiting Indonesia, said the U.S. is looking to forge stronger security alliances in the region and to ensure freedom of navigation in the South China Sea. Beijing claims a large portion of the sea, says the U.S. is exploiting the sovereignty issue to increase its military presence there. Well, joining us to discuss this further, we have Andrew Loing, international independent China strategist, who joins us from Hong Kong. We also have Angelo Giuliano, who's a writer and political analyst, joining us from Montreux. Well, I'd like to welcome you both. Andrew Loing, let me first start with you and ask your reaction to a quote by the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, while touring this region. He has said, "Let me be clear, the goal of defending the rules-based order is not to keep any country down, rather is to protect the right of all countries to choose their own path, free from coercion and intimidation. It could sound like the U.S. doing that, in a sense.
Well, this is clearly a continuation of the United States' campaign to isolate China and to demonize China, falling on the heels of the so-called Democracy Forum. So the great power rivalry with China is now extended to many different fields. Firstly, from trade, and then technology, and then military, South China Sea ideology, and this is a continuation. But as far as the freedom of navigation is concerned, it is in China's interest, of course, to keep the waters free and open, because China relies on these waters for its international trade and import of raw materials. But on the other hand, China has significant territorial claims in the region, and it sees that the region is being cordoned off by the American military assets at the so-called First Island Chain, Second Island Chain, from Okinawa to Guam, and then the American fleets patrolling the areas at the doorstep of China. So there's no reason, there's no surprise that China is calling America out as the thief calling out stop thief.
If we can break this down, Angelo, through you, as to from the outside that is looking in, you're looking at one of the high-profile trips that were made by VP Kamala Harris, I think it was about a month ago, in which she was trying to either assure the regional countries that were behind you, meaning the U.S., or to make sure that they are behind the U.S. indeed. This almost looks like maybe it's a similar type of trip, in a sense, where the U.S. is trying to make sure if regional countries are actually on its side. Are regional countries on the U.S. side, given the very aggressive military, in a sense, posturing that the U.S. in its rhetoric has taken when it comes to China?
I think in the region, there's only Australia, which is a real ally to the U.S. The rest are either hostages or countries that don't want to take sides. You mentioned the trip of Kamala Harris. She actually went to Vietnam, and she exposed a complete ignorance of history. She came back saying that America is back. If you know the history of the region, and especially the war in Vietnam, imagine what it is for Vietnamese to hear that America is back. It's just a joke. Now, if you take the countries in the regions, the trade they have with China is between 30 to 40%. So basically, the containment of China would actually contain the whole region. It's very important not to see the containment of China as being only solely on China, but it would actually contain completely the whole region. Now, as Andrew just mentioned before, the freedom of navigation is above everything, above all, most important to China. Keep in mind that there's a 70 to 80% of oil trade import that is essential to China that is going through the Malacca Strait. And so China right now is extremely nervous about the freedom of navigation in the region, but for its own economy, because the long-term game of the U.S., and I'm referring to Pentagon paper, is to encircle China, because China is the ultimate prize for complete world hegemony. So it's important to look at the long-term game, and the long-term game, you have to look back at the 1960s. The U.S. had already a plan to encircle China. And if you look at the map, all the army bases encircling China and all the regime change attempts that the U.S. did, destabilization in Tibet, in Xinjiang, they're trying to stir up problems in Thailand, in Myanmar. What is happening in Myanmar, that's all about the U.S., trying to install U.S. puppet regime. So there's a policy of containing China, and it's encircling China. And you just look at the map, how encircled is China.
Okay, Andrew Long, so this strait obviously is very important in terms of trade. Over $1 trillion, I believe, flows through it. Is the U.S. indirectly trying to disrupt that in order to hurt China, given how much trade is done and China is part of that equation?
I don't think the United States wants to disrupt the trade. Naturally, the United States wants more allies or perceived allies to be on its side. And recently, the United States, don't forget, has concluded a nuclear submarine deal with Australia and is now doubling down on the so-called court with Canada, Australia, and India. The fact remains, the Asian economy and the Asia-Pacific economy, a lot of them is influenced by the ASEAN nations and its partners. And the recently concluded and introduced the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership is the world's largest trading bloc, accounting for a third of the world's GDP and a third of the world's population. And this trading bloc has China at the center. So most of the countries the United States is trying to woo don't want to take sides. They are much cleverer than that. And even those who turn up at the so-called democratic forum just want to show face to give American face, but without really uttering any kind of open rhetoric against China. So I think that this latest attempt by the Secretary of State and trying to talk Indonesia into the American camp, I think it's likely to be a futile effort.
Okay, thank you very much. A pleasure. Andrew Leung there, International Independent China Strategist from Hong Kong. And thank you for your contribution, Angelo Giuliano, writer and political analyst from Montreux. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Thanks for tuning in. The Yemeni army is pushing to capture the city of Ma'arib from forces who are fighting on behalf of a military coalition led by Saudi Arabia. Army troops and their allied fighters are now in control of several strategic hilltops near Ma'arib after conducting a pincer attack. Local media reports say that the Saudi-backed forces have retreated with heavy losses. At least 30 militants are dead. The battle for Ma'arib seems to be drawing to a close, with the Yemeni army advancing deeper into the territory. On Monday, they killed a top military commander just outside of the city. Ma'arib, the capital of the oil-rich province of the same name, is the last stronghold of the Saudi-led forces in the north. Its liberation is expected to pave the way for the Yemeni army to capture more provinces. The Pentagon has announced that no members of the U.S. military will be punished over a drone strike that killed 10 civilians, including 7 children, in Kabul back in August. This will no doubt enrage many, but should surprise no one, as we find out in the following report.
August 30th. 2021. Grieving and baffled Afghans gather around the mangled vehicle inside a house in Kabul. An apparent explosion a day earlier had killed 10 fellow civilians, including 7 children. The sorrow and confusion, however, would gradually give way to fury and clarity as media reports and investigations emerged over the following days. Finally, some 20 days after the incident, the U.S. decided to come out with the truth, admitting that it had made a, quote, tragic mistake in targeting the civilians. This came after initially defending their strike as righteous and insisting that it struck a Daesh vehicle carrying explosive to blow up Hamid Karzai International Airport. The strike came in the final days of the U.S.-led evacuation of Kabul after the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan. There was widespread condemnation of the attack, with Iran saying the U.S. cannot exonerate itself by downplaying such atrocities as mistakes. Yet, as it now turns out, this is exactly what the U.S. has done, with the Pentagon saying that there will be no disciplinary action against any U.S. troops or officials. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin had received a high-level review of the strike that made no recommendation of accountability.
None of their recommendations dealt specifically with issues of accountability. Secretary reviewed their recommendations. I won't get into all of them. Some of them are understandably classified, but he approved their recommendations. So I do not anticipate there being issues of personal accountability to be had with respect to the August 29th airstrike.
This has further fueled criticism of the U.S., with the acknowledgement of the mistake standing in stunning contrast to its refusal to hold anyone accountable for any wrongdoing. Sadly, the Kabul drone strike against civilians was not a one-off incident. Just last month, a report revealed that the U.S. military had tried to cover up two back-to-back airstrikes against supposed Daesh targets that killed up to 64 women and children in Syria in 2019. In two decades of wars across the world, from Afghanistan through Iraq and Syria to Somalia, the U.S. military has killed hundreds, if not thousands, of civilians. And while the military occasionally accepts responsibility for an errant airstrike or a ground raid that harms civilians, rarely does it ever hold specific individuals accountable. Maybe that trend will change one day when the U.S. itself is held accountable by the international community.
A French warship is now sailing in waters near Russia's borders, adding another shock to the already jittery relations between Moscow and the West. Russia's defense ministry says it's been monitoring all the actions of the French Navy's frigate since it entered the Black Sea. So far, there is no word on the French vessel's mission and how long it will last. This is the latest development in Russia's standoff with NATO over Ukraine. Just a few days ago, the Russian Air Force escorted five U.S. and French aircraft away from its borders. The West accuses Russia of preparing for a war in Ukraine, with the EU warning Moscow of political and economic costs, including sanctions. But Moscow is concerned about NATO's eastward expansion and says its member states, including France, are provoking tensions in the Black Sea. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Following the Holy Prophet in justice.
This is part of the speech delivered on October 24th, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
شما مسئولینی که در اینجا تشریف دارید و مسئولین کشور در همه رده‌ها اونی که از همه چیز براشون مهمتره صبره. بایستی پایداری کنید، مقاومت کنید.
You officials who are here and who hold various positions, what is most important for you is patience. You must persevere, resist, endure pressures, endure hardships, and move on. You should not stop. This requirement of having patience and perseverance is for us who are responsible in this country, and it means that we should not stop. Movement must not stop. It must continue. This is patience.
دقت کن لکن فی رسول الله اسوتون حسنه. این میشه پیروی از پیغمبر.
You have indeed, in the Messenger of Allah, a beautiful model of conduct. This is how we can follow the Holy Prophet's lead. The second point is about justice and equity. One of the most important, perhaps the most important intermediate goals of sending prophets, was to administer justice. We sent aforetime our apostles with clear signs and sent down with them the book and the balance of right and wrong, that men may stand forth in justice. The Holy Quran, Surah 57, verse 25.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
هدف ارسال رسول انزال کتب این بود که قیام به قسط بشود، جامعه قائم به عدل و قسط باشد.
The purpose of sending prophets and divine books was to establish justice and encourage society to work for justice. In the Quran, the Holy Prophet is quoted as saying, "And I am commanded to judge justly between you." The Holy Quran, Surah 42, verse 15. It is God's command for us to establish justice. All wise people in the world accept this. Even the most oppressive, malicious people in the world cannot deny the necessity of having justice. Some even claim to be just with complete shamelessness, despite the fact that they are oppressors.
قرآن کریم عدالت را حتی در مورد دشمنان لازم میدونه.
The Holy Quran mentions that justice should be administered even in the case of enemies. We should not be unjust with respect to a person who is our enemy. And let not the hatred of others to you make you swerve to wrong and depart from justice. Be just, that is next to piety. The Holy Quran, Surah 5, verse 8.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me. Through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On Friday, a bipartisan group of leading members of the U.S. House Committee on Foreign Affairs passed a bill aimed at restricting Iran's defensive military prowess. The Stop Iranian Drones Act would ban the supply, sale, or transfer of military drones to or from Iran under U.S. law. The bill addresses what the U.S. claims to be the growing threat of Iran's unmanned aerial vehicle program. However, despite gaining self-sufficiency in the arms industry by making great progress in developing and manufacturing a broad range of military equipment in recent years, Iran has time and again proven that its military capabilities are purely defensive in the face of moves by the U.S. and its regional allies, which have been fomenting chaos and tension in the region. Like last month, when the Iranian army intercepted two U.S. unmanned aerial vehicles that had penetrated the country's airspace, giving them a stern warning to stay away from the zone where it was holding massive drills. The ban imposed on the Iranian military drones comes amid ongoing talks over the removal of anti-Iran sanctions between Tehran and the signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal in Vienna. The US has for long tried to tie Iran's military capabilities to the talks. However, the Islamic Republic has repeatedly underscored that its defensive capabilities will be never subject to negotiations. The US also baselessly accuses Iran of conducting drone attacks in West Asia, while Washington has blood on its hands for killing thousands of innocent civilians by conducting drone and air strikes in the region. Also, let's not forget that the United States is the leading exporter of arms in the world. Washington attempts to restrict Iran's defensive capabilities while it sells bombs, drones, and arms to other countries like Saudi Arabia that use them in unjust wars like the one in Yemen to kill innocent civilians. In fact, half of U.S. arms transfers between 2016 and 2020 went to West Asia region, particularly Saudi Arabia, leading to more instability and chaos. The U.S. is also guilty of civilian killings in many war theaters, like in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, from drone strikes to other military action. Rights groups have accused Washington of hiding the real number of civilian casualties and underreporting them. Based on the U.S. military's own assertion, Washington has conducted almost 100,000 drone and air strikes in the West Asia region in the past 20 years, according to a new analysis published by the civilian harm monitoring group Air Wars. The U.S. strikes have killed at least 22,000 civilians across various theaters, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan since 2001. The group says the number could probably be as high as 48,000. The U.S. also assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes in a drone strike near the Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. The two were iconic figures in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. That's while top U.S. diplomats have previously admitted that Washington is responsible for the foundation of the Daesh terrorist group. Days after the brazen act, the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps launched a volley of missiles at a major military base housing American forces in Iraq. Iran denounced the assassination as a state terrorism and vowed to end the American presence in the region as the ultimate act of revenge.
Well, clearly, if one was going to have a completely honest and neutral legal international legal system, no country can stand above it. But we don't have that. And in fact, we have a system where the people who've got the arms and the money make the decisions. So obviously, if we were to say that any time a country used a drone and killed other civilians, there was going to be sanctions, clearly those countries that have drones, in particular this country, would have to be sanctioned. But that's simply not going to happen.
Political dynamics in West Asia have been undergoing an overhaul since earlier this year, when U.S. President Joe Biden announced his country will withdraw its troops from Afghanistan following 20 years of war, and Washington's Western allies followed suit. Just this week, U.S.-led forces ended their combat mission in Iraq, switching to advisory roles in the country. The departure of foreign troops comes amid growing anti-West sentiments in the region and a shift in the focus of Washington's foreign policy from West Asia to China and Russia. That has brought the regional countries together to address the challenges facing the region. One instance is Qatar, which had been under a blockade by Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates since June 2017. That went on until January this year, when the quartet agreed to end the diplomatic row. In the meantime, Saudi Arabia and Egypt have appointed new ambassadors to Qatar. Trade and travel links have also been re-established with Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Egypt, but not with Bahrain.
He has noticed that this American support is limited to just maintaining Saudi Arabia as an outpost of military, of U.S. imperial projection and power play in the region. And of course, when this U.S. support were to be removed or to be reduced, Saudi Arabia, as well as the UAE, as well as Bahrain, as Qatar, and Kuwait, they need more pillars to work with. They need more legs to stand on. And one of the best things to do in this region is collaborate and cooperate with the governments already exist and try to bridge the differences that might exist between various countries.
Qatar's emir has traveled to Saudi Arabia and met Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman several times since then. On Wednesday, bin Salman made his first official visit to Qatar since he was named Crown Prince in 2017. A senior official at the Iranian Foreign Ministry says the development of ties and cooperation with the neighboring countries is among the priorities of the new administration in Tehran. Alireza Inayati says trips and negotiations by the Iranian officials in recent months are all proof of that policy. He says Iran has good ties with the Persian Gulf Arab states, including the UAE, Oman, and Kuwait. Inayati heads the Iranian Foreign Ministry's Office for Persian Gulf Affairs. He was speaking with the Iranian Arabic news channel Al Alam. Inayati also said Iran and Saudi Arabia have held four rounds of talks since September to mend their ties and plan more negotiations. He cited progress in the talks, saying they were friendly and constructive. Ties severed between Tehran and Riyadh in 2016. The two have differences on some regional issues, including the Yemen war. For years, the kingdom pursued a confrontational foreign policy toward the Islamic Republic, but it has recently appeared to have changed track.
When it comes down to it, they are two nations that border the Arab Gulf. They are two nations that are in a very strategic area to border the Gulf region, border the Persian Gulf, the Straits of Hormuz. So these all areas that are of a vitally strategic importance. And when push comes to shove, it is them who have to live there, not the United States, not the United Kingdom or the European Union or any of these Western powers. It is the Iranians, it is the Arabs, the Saudis, the Iraqis, the Kuwaitis, the Qataris who have to live in this region, have to find a way to keep on living. This is something that I believe a couple of years ago that the Iranian government already said, and when it comes down to it, this should be a regional decision.
The recent developments in the region signal a paradigm shift in the ties between West Asian countries. The jury is still out on what that would mean for the United States' interests and influence in the region.
Germany has a new chancellor. Social Democrat Olaf Scholz has been sworn in as Germany's new chancellor, ending 16 years of conservative rule under Angela Merkel. Scholz, who is now 63, had served as vice chancellor and finance minister in Merkel's outgoing government. He got 395 votes from lawmakers in the lower house of parliament. Scholz will oversee a liberal-left coalition government between the Social Democratic Party, the SPD, the Greens, and the Liberal Free Democratic Party, or the FDP. This is the first power-sharing agreement of such a kind in Germany, and the first governing alliance with three parties since 1957. Merkel's final days as chancellor was her 5,860th day in office, falling short of the record set by her late former mentor, Helmut Kohl, by mere 10 days.
Well, the positive is that she kept the German economy strong. Germany is still an export powerhouse. There are signs of a certain weakening, but still its position is very strong. She left very popular, which is very important. Clearly, Germans liked her steady, somewhat conservative leadership, and she certainly established Germany as the preeminent power in the European Union.
The alliance brings to a close 16 years of rule by Angela Merkel, who chose not to run again. Germany's incoming government has agreed that EU authorities should act more urgently to defend the rule of law, including withholding EU funds if necessary.
I mean, the pressures that are pulling apart the EU are growing. After Brexit, people became frightened and decided, you know, that maybe leaving the EU was not such a great idea. But now these centrifugal forces are reasserting themselves. the EU is torn between East and West, North and South, but the East European countries are pushing a much more confrontational policy vis-a-vis Russia. They're allying themselves with the United States, and France and Germany are caught in the middle. And they're kind of trapped, and they aren't sure what to do.
The new government has ambitious plans to fight climate change by phasing out coal early and focusing on renewable energy. But their initial priority will be tackling the coronavirus pandemic. Angela Merkel served alongside four U.S. presidents, four French presidents, five British prime ministers, and eight Italian premiers. Her chancellorship was marked by four major challenges: the global financial crisis, Europe's debt crisis, the 2015-16 influx of refugees to Europe, and the coronavirus pandemic. While credited with securing huge European bailouts that saved Greece from crashing out of the Eurozone, it was achieved at a heavy social cost. Merkel was highly unpopular for being the driving force behind bailouts and austerity cuts. The policy made millions of people jobless, plunging them into poverty. Merkel also kept Germany's borders open to hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing the wars in Syria and Iraq. But the policy drew criticism from right-wing politicians. The refugee influx gave a good excuse to far-right groups to fan the flames of Islamophobia. Popular anger also sent the far-right bloc, the anti-immigration AfD, to parliament in 2017 for the first time since World War II, making it the biggest opposition force. Merkel's government was accused of protecting Germany's vital automobile industry by watering down emissions regulation reforms, and its refusal to advance the 2038 deadline to quit coal energy also irking green activists.
And she's been caught in the middle of a lot of conflicts and has not acquitted herself especially well. And that includes the Ukraine and Iran, especially the JCPOA, the 2015 nuclear accord. And there, Germany under Merkel mostly towed the U.S. line and did not get very many rewards for it. They lost business opportunities in Iran, and they have been kind of chained to an increasingly erratic U.S. policy.
Her government also did not play a constructive role after the nuclear deal with Iran in 2015. Germany under Merkel practically followed the maximum pressure campaign of the U.S. against Iran and did not fulfill its obligations under the deal.
The United States withdrew all of its forces from Afghanistan in August in what was widely described as a humiliating pullout after a 20-year futile war. But America has not left the West Asia region at all, as it retains a large number of its forces in this strategic part of the world. Iraq and Syria are two of the regional countries the United States seems very reluctant to leave. The United States invaded Iraq 18 years ago and had 170,000 soldiers there in 2007, before withdrawing them in 2011. It redeployed forces to Iraq in 2014 as the Daesh terrorist group seized Iraqi territory. A large part of the Iraqi population, including resistance groups, consider the U.S. forces as occupiers. America currently has about 2,500 troops and leads another 1,000 foreign forces in Iraq. Pressure has been mounting on Iraqi officials to force the U.S. to pull its remaining soldiers out of the country. The Iraqi parliament voted in January 2020 to expel U.S. forces from Iraq. The vote came amid heightened anti-American sentiments following the U.S. assassination of Iranian anti-terror icon General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes. The U.S. military on Thursday announced the end of its combat mission in Iraq. But does that genuinely change anything on the ground? The move won't reduce the number of U.S. troops in Iraq. Rather, it will keep the same numbers in, quote, support roles. Why is the United States resisting growing calls for a complete withdrawal?
The objective of the United States in Syria and Iraq is to act on behalf of Israel, strategically, that is, and to create obstacles to the governments of Syria, Iraq, and Iran and Lebanon, for that matter, because these four nations and important parts within those four nations are to some extent allied. They feel themselves under oppression and attack by the United States and its allies.
Many observers believe the U.S. wants to keep its base in Iraq as part of its efforts to maintain its influence in Iraq and try to contain regional player Iran, among other goals. When Daesh began seizing large parts of Iraq and Syria in 2014, the U.S. was widely accused of involvement in the creation of the terrorist group. Some even inside the United States, like former President Donald Trump, said the group was created by the United States. America ironically deployed troops to Iraq and northern Syria as part of its mission to battle the terrorists. There are still hundreds of American forces in northern Syria who refuse to leave as repeatedly demanded by Damascus. This week, the Syrian president's political and media advisor, Bhutina Shaban, said the U.S., under the guise of its anti-terrorism mission, intervened in Syria, occupied parts of the country, and plundered its resources like oil and natural gas.
Well, the U.S. has, against all international law, walked into Syria with its military. And it has destroyed and occupied and stolen the vast majority of the oil resources of Syria in order to prevent it from getting into the hands of the Syrian government, to impoverish the Syrian people and the Syrian government, and to destroy the economy. That's what this is about.
She also denounced the repeated U.S. airstrikes against residential areas, which have caused a large number of civilian casualties over the past years. Shaban said the air raids are a severe violation of the nation's human rights and Syrian sovereignty. She called the continued U.S. military presence in Syria a naked aggression. Before coming into office, U.S. President Joe Biden pledged to end America's forever wars. But unlike Afghanistan, there has been little talk about any U.S. withdrawal from Syria. U.S. officials with knowledge of the Biden administration's plans said recently that the United States would not be pulling out from northeast Syria anytime soon.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره، همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام ازهد في الدنيا يبصرك الله عوراتها ولا تغفل فلست بمغفول عنك.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Imam Ali alayhi salam stated, "Abstain from the world so that Allah may show you its real evils, and do not be neglectful, because in any case you will not be neglected."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam, this divinely appointed Imam from the household of the Holy Prophet, this first divinely appointed Imam, this successor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, divinely appointed successor, we find that his words and his actions reflected his persona, and his persona was the most perfect role model for humanity, for it was a copy of the most perfect role model for humanity, the Holy Prophet Muhammad. We find in this book by the name of Al-Irshad by Sheikh Al-Mufid, in volume 1, page 296, that there is a statement which he records from Imam Ali alayhi salam. This beautiful Imam, he says, "Every speech in which there is no name or remembrance of Allah is abortive, and every silence which is not based upon pondering is forgetfulness, and every vision which is not admonitory, critical, is idle." In this one sentence, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam has shown us so many different facets for life, these aspects, again, these aspects which are a part of Imam Ali alayhi salam. They are a part of his persona. It is who he is. And so he teaches humanity these different lessons. The first one being that every speech in which there is no dhikr of Allah is abortive, is futile, is going to go to waste. Now, does this mean that everything that we say must involve the remembrance and the name of Allah? Perhaps this is one way that we can think about it. Then again, everything that we say, we try to say Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim in the beginning, right? And this would qualify as having the name or the remembrance of Allah in that statement. Now, another potential thing that we can understand from here is that, well, you should at least remember Allah in your mind and in your heart when you are speaking. And so, even though your speech might be about something like physics, but still you are remembering Allah, and therefore the dhikr, the remembrance of Allah, is accompanied with what you are saying. And yet another interpretation, another explanation for this could be that when we do speak, the best kind of speech is that speech which is about Allah. It is about religion. It is about the different aspects of Islam. And that is the most important kinds of speech. Just quickly going on, the next part was that every silence not based on pondering is forgetfulness. And so silence is golden, but not a silence where your mind is empty and your heart is empty and your soul is empty. No, silence means that you should be thinking. That is why you are silent. When you are silent, you should be reflecting, contemplating, thinking, not just a baseless silence, which Imam Ali calls forgetfulness. And finally, we have this idea that every vision which is not critical is idle. Of course, basira is, I believe, what is being spoken about here. But this vision, this intuition, if it is not critical, then it is idle. Of course, our vision, our thinking should be critical. It should and first and foremost, critical of ourselves before we go and start criticizing other people. But critical of ourselves, our actions, our behaviors, our speech, and our morals and our ethics. Three very small pieces of advice, but very profound, that if we wanted to continue, we could continue the program, but we will have to suffice it at that. Profound lessons brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Kul صبحا وكل شرابا تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib this means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Youthful age today is considered to be the age of energy, the age where the individual is able and wanting to transform and to change things and has the willingness and the desire and the hunger to be able to put the effort in. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when it comes to this youthful age, it is considered in Islamic studies and teachings to be an age of immense importance. And when you look at the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen, there is so much to be gained for our youngsters and for our elders in raising their kids in the path of the religion of Islam under the umbrella of the wilaya of Amir al-Mu'mineen. When we examine how he lived his youthful age, let's look at two situations and seek to derive lessons from that particular element, which then formed and shaped the character of Amir al-Mu'mineen. The first is when he was 10 years of age. What happened? The Prophet of Islam receives the revelation for the first time. Jibra'il descends on Rasulullah Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Iqra' bismi rabbika alladhi khalaq. Read in the name of your Lord. We believe the Prophet was absolutely aware. He was not hesitant. He was not shaky. He was not unsure. He was firm in his knowledge that he is a prophet from God. This is the first revelation. Who is the first to receive him and to support him? A 10-year-old boy who never bowed down to any idols. And that's why out of all the Sahaba today, he is referred to by our brothers as Karramallahu Wajha. May Allah illuminate his face, because his face never bowed down to an idol. He never prostrated other than Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And this 10-year-old comes, wants to support the Prophet. The Prophet says to him, what? Yes, come with me. He doesn't say you're very young. The Prophet of Islam doesn't dismiss him. Doesn't say,